Good afternoon, and welcome to Coastal Conversations, here on WERU. We explore issues facing Maine's coastal communities through dialogue with people who live, work, and play on our coast. From fisheries to tourism, from energy to environment, from economy to ecology, we go beyond the social media soundbites, probing deeply into complex issues and solutions. Coastal Conversations is supported by Maine Sea Grant in partnership with the Scudic Institute and the First Coast. Welcome to this month's episode of Coastal Conversations. My name is Kristen Zanino, production assistant of this episode of Coastal Conversations, the second episode in a two-part series about the changing marine ecology from professional scuba divers occupying Maine's coast. These scuba divers have a unique perspective on Maine's coastal ecosystems as they are under the water, fully immersed in the underwater landscape. In the last episode, you heard from divers in Down East Maine. Now let's travel down the coast to the Mid-Coast and Greater Portland area. You'll hear from Richard Wally, a retired lobster scientist at the University of Maine, Levi Robbins, manager of the Aqua Dive Academy in Portland, Paul Rollins, the owner of the Rollins Scuba Associates, Phoebe Jekalek, a kelp and shellfish scientist at the University of Maine, Emily Drapool, dive master for Oceans Wide Ghost Trap Recovery and Processing Organization, and Marissa McMahon, Senior Director of Fisheries at Manumit Conservation Sciences, plus a member of the Maine Climate Council. These six divers, collectively, have 166 years of diving experience in Maine under their belt, with jobs in research, marine conservation, and scuba businesses. They all dive as part of their careers. Maine's underwater landscape is a secondary home.
My name is Phoebe Jekalek. My relationship with Maine is deep, emotional, fun, and committed. Something that I love is just the seaweed and the rock of the seaweed back and forth with the waves or the tide.
Through the University of Maine, Phoebe Jekalek and Marissa McMahon conduct research on nursery-like ecosystems of seaweed and eelgrass beds. These are protective spaces for organisms to hide and take shelter, as well as provide food by eating the smaller organisms nearby. They gear up and dive down to survey and observe what these habitats have endured through the years. There are multiple threats to these ecosystems around Casco Bay, Southern Maine, that Marissa McMahon and Phoebe Jekalek speak on. Now let's go, gear up, and dive down.
Someone I work with. At the outset of the field season, she went to Broad Cove to dive on the eelgrass bed that had been there 2 years before, and it was completely gone over the course of just 2 years, completely wiped out. So we had to completely shift gears, find another site, figure out what we were going to do, because in some places that is the scale of change, the magnitude of change. It's happening really fast. In terms of the turbidity of the water, eelgrass needs light to grow and survive and thrive. So anything that's impacting the amount of light that reaches the eelgrass bed, anything that is influencing the sediment that the eelgrass is growing in. So the part of the project that we're focused on is looking at green crabs, because green crabs will, which is an invasive species, they'll burrow into the sediment and uproot the eelgrass. And green crabs are really thriving because of warming waters, and they're very abundant in Casco Bay. So there's sort of a multitude of different things that, you know, might be leading to the decrease in eelgrass.
You know, we have green crabs and blue crabs coming up here, right? And they're messing with the eelgrass beds that other organisms need for, like, nursery areas, you know, or settlement areas, blue carbon sinks. So there's just so many different kinds of impacts that, you know, I think it's really hard to measure and pretty wild to, like, wrap your whole head around.
Paul Rowlands dives extensively in Kettle Cove around the eelgrass beds.
But when you look at East End Beach, or you look at the Cove area, whatever, around some of the islands in Casco Bay, where there's a lot of these eelgrass beds, have the mooring, but you've got to keep the rest of the chain stuff up when the tidal shifts. Otherwise, it goes down and cuts the eelgrass. It's a circle basically being blown around by the wind on the surface, kills all the underground eelgrass. That's a big issue.
The health of these nursery habitats are important for protecting the native fish and invertebrates, especially during the vulnerable beginning stages of their lives. In the last episode, we heard about the green crabs being a huge pest here in Maine, as these invasive species thrive here, trying to outcompete and eat the native species. In recent years, blue crabs have expanded their range north, being introduced to southern and mid-coast Maine waters. The native Jonah and rock crabs have to compete for space and resources. Emily Drapool joins in to tell us what she notices.
A lot of difference in rock crab versus green crab. Green crabs are extremely, extremely invasive, and the rock crabs used to kind of rule around here, and we're seeing less and less and less of them.
You know, we've definitely seen the dominant species sort of shifting, just in terms of seeing a lot of, like, rock crabs and things like that, certainly more than we used to. That's one of our newer research projects. We're focused on tracking the range expansion of blue crabs. We've been doing a lot of trapping and mark recapture. So we've tagged probably over 80 at this point over the last 2 years in a location in mid-coast Maine, which is called the New Meadows Lakes, sort of in between West Bath and Brunswick. So they're very abundant in some areas. You'll find pockets of them where, yeah, there's a lot.
The one you hear more of is the green crabs that are eating everything. Well, I have a philosophy about green crabs. They make good food for the other fish that you might have out there. If I see a green crab, it does not survive.
Unfortunately, green and blue crabs aren't the only invasive species that cause harm to these nursery-like habitats, especially the kelp beds. In Maine, kelp beds have gone through periods of regression, from urchins gorging on them, to flourishing with the collapse of the urchin diving fishery. And now, this ecosystem must compete against invasive species. Richard Wally relates back to when he used to see pincushions of urchin barrens.
And the biggest change is that shift from sea urchin barrens to kelp-dominated habitats everywhere, and then the subsequent shift of the more invasive species. I'm thinking Pemaquid Point as being a prime example, where I dive very frequently. And during the 80s, I witnessed that location turn from an urchin barrens to a kelp bed. A dramatic change.
One of the research projects that I work on now is really focused on looking at kelp ecosystems and how kelp ecosystems are changing over time. Even just in the course of those 7 years, we've seen, you know, kind of a decrease in the health of the kelp ecosystem, you know, not as much kelp as there has been. And oftentimes the kelp that we're seeing has a lot of, you know, other stuff growing on it. So colonial organisms like tunicates and things like that. So kind of a general decline in kelp. I mean, when the sea urchins sort of the abundance collapsed, kelp definitely bounced back and was doing really well, but it's also a very cold water loving species. And so as waters are warming, and then also these sort of invasive species that coat the blades of the kelp and sort of weigh it down just makes it less resilient, and certainly to storms and impacts like that, that the heavy, you know, sort of tunicates on top of the kelp are kind of just creating an environment where it's just harder to survive.
Broader, longer term changes are the presence of tunicates.
Invasive tunicates encrust hard surfaces in areas where currents flow over them, supplying the filter feeders with nutrients.
One of the projects that we're also working on is monitoring biodiversity in natural oyster beds. So we see a lot of tunicates in those areas, and just, you know, not something that I remember seeing as much of, certainly, or even as many different species of invasive tunicate when I first started diving.
Smaller shellfish, you got mussels, you got oysters, the coral species, the sponge species that we see. I'll pull up a trap and it's just encrusted. And half of it's been sitting in the mud for a decade.
The rope, encrusted with shellfish, tunicates, and other invertebrates, are from ghost traps. Emily Drapul works for the organization's Oceanswide. In the first episode of this two-part series, on divers' perspective of Maine's changing marine ecology, we heard from Buzz Campbell-Scott, who runs Oceanswide. An organization aimed to mitigate the ghost trap problem in Maine. With scattered lobster traps and highly trafficked waters, lines can be cut from their buoys and abandoned on the seafloor, moving in entangled bait balls in highly active waters. Emily works alongside Buzz Campbell-Scott by collecting and hauling up these ghost traps, cleaning up the seafloor.
But Booth Bay Harbor is really, really an interesting kind of micro ecosystem because it's real snug up in there, kind of like a lot of harbors in Maine, but it's also very frequently traveled in the summer, especially by boat. It's kind of just bare down there. It's a lot of mud, not a lot going on. There's a lot of lobster traps. A lot that have been cut. I've done a lot of diving in Booth Bay Harbor. Like we dove for an entire summer. We actually took up 3,600 lobster traps out of that harbor alone above 60 feet. 60% of the traps that we find are still fishing. I also work in the restaurant industry. So whenever I'd like bring people lobster, and it was supposed to be a season or like a time for a lot of hard shell, they were soft. I started thinking about it more when I was doing my other job. And we were pulling lobsters out of these traps that we were pulling up. I started squeezing them a little bit and picking them up, and they're definitely shorter, and they're definitely, their shell isn't as fortified as it should be.
You are listening to WERU Community Radio at 89.9 FM and streaming online at weru.org. When Emily Drapul describes the ghost traps as still fishing, she means it quite literally. There are vents in the lobster traps where organisms come into the kitchen, eat what is left in the bait bags or what is growing on the trap, and then are eaten by a lobster too big to leave the vents. If the critter is lucky, it'll be small enough to exit the escape vents. Or the Oceanwide's team, collecting the ghost traps, finds and releases them before retrieving the trap. Emily mentions how when she releases lobsters, she squeezes the sides of the shells to feel the strength. In recent years, she's observed shells being thinner and points to ocean acidification as the cause. Let's look at some of the other shellfish and invertebrates that are harvested for food and what changes they exhibit through the years.
There used to be a lot more scallops out there and bigger ones too. I mean, I had four scallops that made a pound one day. They were at least 3 inches up and about 2 or 3 inches in diameter. They were huge.
You know, some other changes I've seen right down the peninsula from us is Chamberlain along the Pemaquid Peninsula here. It's been monitored for many years for mussels and intertidal invertebrates. And the mussel bed is tremendously depleted, and apparently, and that's a pretty widespread phenomenon too. But that's one location that's been monitored pretty intensively for years, going back to the again, like the late 60s, and the mussel bed has always been a major feature there. And now it's, you sort of have to hunt and turn over rocks to find mussels. And I'm reasonably sure that green crabs have played an important role there too.
My name is Levi Robbins. For a variety of reasons, you don't see a lot of urchins anymore. There aren't a lot of urchin divers out there. The abundance of urchins has changed pretty significantly in that time frame.
When I first started diving at Kettle Cove, Cape Elizabeth, you could not put your foot down on the rocky ledge area without stepping on urchins. I can't find an urchin in Kettle Cove to show a student what one looks like. I haven't seen many in most of the places. They've all been harvested.
We depend on these invertebrates as food and tourism staples, but their numbers are retreating. What about the organisms that are used for educational purposes, like sea stars?
Sea stars, they're hard to find in some areas now to show a student what one looks like. Plus, they were also hit with some type of a fungus of something, because State Pier, for example, on the waterfront, there used to be thousands of them. I might see one or two now. But there was a period where, one, we were harvested a little, but two, if you found one, it was just falling apart. It was mush. Something had killed it about 15 years ago. Yes, because I dived State Pier with either myself or the police dive teams for training two or three times a year. So one year, first one in the spring, they were there, and by the end of the year, they weren't.
This phenomenon has been observed by divers in the Down East episode as well. Sea stars used to be collected and processed in jars for educational purposes. If pollutants or diseases are responsible for the decline of these sea star populations, what is happening to the other organisms and the habitats they live in? What are the overarching causes of change in Maine's marine ecology that have been observed by these divers? Overall, the answers received focused on climate change and its implications.
Predominantly warming water. Yeah, I mean, certainly the movement of invasive species is not, always specifically linked to warming water, but, we're seeing sort of invasive species that maybe were really rare at one point that are now kind of thriving and just doing really well in these warming conditions. And then native species that are not doing as well because, they're cold water species and not very tolerant of warming water and warming conditions.
We'll get some tropicals that wander off the Gulf Stream and can see them up here in the summertime sometimes.
There are lots of kind of cascading changes due to changes in the ecology of the environment and how with new species comes new interactions. With changes in the warming waters comes new behaviors or new responses from some organisms. So I think there are a lot of things out there happening that we don't really have our finger on. We can't really get the pulse of, because it is so complicated and so complex.
Then you've got some of the other invasive stuff that's killing off some of the other stuff, which will affect the availability of food chain for different creatures.
I feel like it's very much on the razor edge balance a little bit, kind of like we keep putting one thing on the scale and seeing what will happen to the other. And at one point we're gonna reach a tipping point. As far as the lobster and their shell composite goes, I think there's a little bit of well, not a little bit, a lot of ocean acidification draw coming from there, just because we used to have lobsters with like really, really tough shells, and those can only come about by calcium carbonate. And the way ocean acidification affects them is that the calcium carbonate is being drawn away to other molecules, and so they don't have enough to be building their shells with, so they become softer. And that's just another effect of like ocean warming and all of that jazz.
Ocean acidification is caused by the ocean absorbing excess carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, lowering the pH and causing the water to be more acidic. High carbon emissions accelerate ocean acidification, becoming deadly to invertebrates that use calcium carbonate in their exoskeletons. Lobster exoskeletons are partially composed of calcium carbonate, leaving them vulnerable to acidic waters. Paul Rowlands adds why he suspects the ecology is changing.
I think there are several things that will contribute to the ocean generally. One is pollution. So I think human waste pollution, runoff, big issue. We've had a couple of real bad storms the last year or two, and I've seen up to 3 feet of sand that's underwater now is up by the outhouses at Kettle Cove. It used to have a nice sandy beach, and now it's a little sandy with a lot of rocks. The storms have desolated certain areas, which I assume desolated the food availability or whatever.
In recent years, the storms have been so intense that the coastlines have been reshapen. Sediments are swept away and in turn change what can live in these nearby coastal marine habitats. Levi Robbins has a more optimistic outlook on what these changes are contributed to.
Things are absolutely changing, but nature, just like anything else, finds its equilibrium, and that's constantly changing, just as we do. So I would dare to guess that there's a bunch of environmental factors there that certainly cause that. I think what's great is we continue to try and understand those and figure out why it's happening, and then, you know, maybe there's some answers to moving forward with that and either solving it if it's a bad thing or understanding it if it's a good thing. So
there are many threats to these marine habitats. Whether it may be driven by certain events or part of a cycle, either way, it can be a concern for Maine's extensive working waterfront. When asked what Maine policymakers should prioritize in the marine sector, interviewees focused on restoring healthy marine ecosystems and to be aware.
Like expanding the diversity of fisheries that we're able to access is a big key issue. All of it, sort of at the end of the day, is really rooted in healthy marine ecosystems, because without healthy marine ecosystems, you know, we're not going to have fisheries at all. We're not going to have resources that support coastal communities.
But the way that I would approach lawmakers, just because their mind is also going to be on economic stability, would be with the trap problem first, because it is a kind of villain that you can attack at the moment, and then we've got to face facts about climate change and ocean acidification and what they're doing biologically to the lobsters and the crabs and our shellfish industry, because that's a bigger problem than I think just the state of Maine can handle.
Awareness, education, training.
What can we do to help?
The easiest way to understand the changing environment is to go to a beach and walk. You will find all of this, the abandoned traps, the tags, the buoys, the line, the bait, like the bait mesh that they put bait in. Find those everywhere. And you'll find it.
I think that starting at the town level is something that is really accessible to a lot of people, and honestly is one of the places where most of the most, you know, impactful decisions are made.
Maine's marine ecology is changing rapidly in response to a chain of environmental factors. Divers witness these fluctuations in marine abundance and diversity at frequently visited dive sites.
Well, as an instructor, you adapt because you want your students, especially newer students, to have fun and enjoy and see marine life. So instead of pointing out a whole bunch of fish now, you point out things that don't move very fast or move very far.
We spend a lot of time on the water here in Maine. We don't spend as much time in the water, you know, and so that's something that has been an adjustment for me. You know, there's lots of sailors, lots of fishermen, you know, lots of people doing research, and most of the time it is on the water from boats. It is the minority of people that get in the water and do diving or snorkeling or, you know, even surfing.
Thank you for joining the second episode of this two-part series about the changing marine ecology through the lenses of Maine scuba divers. My name is Kristen Zanino, production assistant of this episode of Coastal Conversations, senior at College of the Atlantic, and Paddy Dive Master. For my senior project, I have put together this two-part series to showcase scuba divers' unique perspective of the changing marine ecology as they are fully immersed in the underwater environment. This episode could not be possible without the passionate scuba divers sharing their stories and observations, giving us a glimpse into the underwater world and the problems it faces in Maine. Thank you, Richard Wally, a retired lobster scientist at the University of Maine, Levi Robbins, manager of Aqua Dive Academy in Portland, Paul Rowlands, the owner of Rowlands Scuba Associates, Phoebe Jekulek, a kelp and shellfish scientist at the University of Maine, Emily Jopul, dive master for Oceans Wide, a ghost trap recovery and processing organization, and Marissa McMahon, senior director of fisheries at Manumit Conservation Sciences, plus a member of the Maine Climate Council, for supporting this project and entrusting me with your voices. Thank you for tuning in to this month's episode of Coastal Conversations. Join us on the fourth Friday of each month at 4 p.m. for information, stories, and conversations about the issues and people of the Maine coast. That great music you're hearing in the background is called A Following Sea and was composed and performed by Paul Anderson. On behalf of Maine Sea Grant, in partnership with the Scudic Institute and the First Coast, we wish you a good weekend.